I went over it with a small tooth comb, however, and satisfied myself that, barring accidents, the machinery would last a good number of years. It took the two of us the best part of all day to inspect the installation. When we had finished our work, Jensen drove me in his Jeep to the country club, which was situated on the River Cauca. I remember that as we drove there, we chatted about the paradox of the Indians of that area living in abject poverty, while the vast Amazonian backlands were a potential source of unlimited vegetable and mineral wealth. Extraction was the problem. The country club provided all the amenities of civilization, and I was able to relax for 3 whole days in Cali. I felt much refreshed, and would have liked to have stayed there for a longer time, but I was working to a fine schedule. The foundation work for the pilot scheme in Lima was due to be completed within the week. I had heard so much about the endless tropical hell of the American jungle that I decided to return to Lima by the craziest route imaginable. There was one snag. There were no jet flights in those territories. True, there were local airlines, but you could well find yourself in a plane where the doors were locked with a strip of telephone wire. If you went to the toilet, you lifted the seal and found yourself looking straight down at the ground, some 12,000 feet below. As well as carrying passengers, these local lines also hump freight, so you could well be sitting among old kitchen equipment, metal tables, rusty chairs, ancient refrigerators. The plane I took on my crazy journey back to Lima was grossly overloaded. This was reflected in takeoff. The plane hurtled down the runway, and seemed reluctant to leave it. When the end of the runway was perilously close, the plane was a grudging yard off the ground. I prayed to all the saints that there were no hoardings, trees or tall obstructions in the takeoff path. My prayers must have been answered, for the plane eventually gained height without stalling. I breathed once more. These old-time planes are piloted by the best-dressed pilots I have ever encountered in all my travels. They are perfumed and mustachioed, wear white gloves, and have a charm and nonchalance all their own. They are not in the least bit worried about the lack of altitude when hurtling down a runway. It takes a little more time to get a load into the air, and that is all that concerns them. The flight from Cali is an endless one over treetops until altitude has to be gained in order to cross the backbone of the Andes. Once over the towering peaks, there is a descent until the flight path levels once more over the jungle, the endless jungle. The last remaining, unconquered natural wonder of the world, a land with its thousands of rivers and lakes, its deadly snakes and insects, its horrible piranhas, the most carnivorous of all fish, this cursed part of the last Estancia del Diablo, the last remaining foothold of the devil on earth, with its clean-picked skeletons along the river banks, its fevers, cannibals and constant death. This region is a challenge to the few remaining adventurers. It is the land of the mighty Imazan, the labyrinthine Caca, Maranon, Jarua, Perua, Putumayo and Ucayali. From the air, it seems as if no living soul could remain alive one single day within this inhospitable murderous jungle. Most of the area is still unexplored, unvisited by modern man. This fact is indicated by white patches on even the best maps, a convention in map-making that hides the vastness of the swamps, and the countless tributaries of the many mighty rivers. But those self-same swamps have given birth to Indians, at once the most stoical and most cruel on earth. It has been known for one of them to wander in from the forest with a hand hacked off at the wrist. There is just no way to tell from his face how he is reacting. There is just no way to make these Indians show emotion if they do not want to do so. Incas or Aztecas of the highlands are just as impassive as their brothers of the swamps. When the Spanish Inquisition burned the feet off the Indians, after they had stolen their land, they simply would not believe that mortal man could be possessed of such courage. Some Spaniards went back to Spain and told their compatriots that they had murdered the rain or sun gods in person. Under the most acute pain they looked at them with loathing as the flames consumed the lower parts of their bodies. Perhaps it is the effect of the coca-chewing habit of the Amazon Indians that makes them impervious to emotion. Whatever it is, their conduct under stress remains one of the mysteries of human behavior. After some hours of jungle hopping, and with the necessary modicum of luck, the endless waves of tree tops give way to the mightiest river in the world. The plane lands, and you step into the natural Turkish bath of the Amazonian interior. Now you know why most of the Amazon Indians wander around naked. With that heat, who needs clothes? At the small airport, I was met by Mr. Mike Salikis, a dealer in animals, birds, reptiles and fish. He was great as a host, and, incidentally, the perfect amphitryon to those in need of adventure. He took me along to his estancia, where he keeps a fine collection of snakes, monkeys, and other elements of his stock in trade. He also has an office there, from which he functions as consular agent of the USA. I mention Mr. Salikis's secondary occupation of amphitryon because he acts as go-between for many people who briefly seek escape from the pressures of modern civilization, and who come to take a quick look at this part of the still natural savage world. These people do not come merely to hunt and to fish. Many of them wish to see how the Amazonian Indian lives in his native habitat. Providing all these services is the work of an amphitryon because he acts as go-between for many in good measure. In his office he keeps a printed list of excursions which are available for the adventure seekers. He refers to them as drippers. On page 3 of this list, there is the following information. Service number 5, 30-minute boat trip to Mariacu Indian village in nearby Brazil, home of the Tiuna Indians. Here is an opportunity to observe their traditions, customs, and items used in their everyday living. By chance, the hair-pulling ceremony may also be observed if scheduled by the family concerned. Duration 4 hours. The list does not explain if those 4 hours are devoted entirely to the hair-pulling ceremony. This ceremony is, in fact, performed on some naked forest beauty's private parts. You would imagine that, with all the teeming life in the forests, a lot of fellows from Chicago and the other North American cities would be coming down to this neck of the woods for the hunting and fishing. Mr. Salikis assures me, however, that his boatmen, who chaperone the visitors, tell him that they come down merely to take pictures of the hair-pulling ceremony. I would have liked to have gone on a hunting trip with Mike Salikis, some 40 miles upriver, where the evergreen lakes of Lortoiku are situated, but unfortunately I was taken ill and had to stay in bed when the others set off. The jaguars, ocelots, tapirs and capybaras would all have to wait until I got better. I became so ill that I really thought I was going to die. Letitia, where Mike Salikis is stationed, is situated some 2,000 miles from the mouth of the Amazon. It is just south of the equator, and has a very small population. I was suffering from kidney trouble, and a kidney operation in Letitia was just not on. The town's industries, apart from catering for a small tourist trade, are making soap and soft drinks. This economy does not need a very large labor force, so there is no need for a fully equipped hospital in the town. My best chance of survival was to take the military flying boat to Iquitos, the capital of the state of Lortu in nearby Peru. I hope nobody else has to endure torture of a severe kidney attack in the cockpit of a military flying boat, with the temperature at 110 Fahrenheit. The ancient aircraft I flew in was nearly 20 years old, and looked it. But there was simply no other way of getting to Iquitos from Mike Salikis's place. There are just no civilian air services between Letitia, which is in Colombia, and Iquitos, which, as I have said, is over the border in Peru. Just to get into the ramshackle flying boat was an adventure itself. You have to cross the tremendous Amazon swamp where the Indian River settlement is situated. There is a mighty splash of muddy water. A door opens, and you are invited to climb aboard. The Peruvian Air Force unit stationed at Lortu's border with Ecuador offers this remarkable passenger service twice a week. The funny thing was that, when I clambered off the flying boat at Iquitos, I felt a little better. I was given a friendly warning about the poor service at the Iquitos hospital, so I decided to postpone the operation, and wait until I could catch a flight back to Lima. In Iquitos, One hears all sorts of stories about the men who have dared to invade this sickening hell of the Amazon jungle. The name of Immanuel Cantu springs to mind, as does that of Colonel Fawcett, the famous British adventurer, who discovered many new rivers, lakes and Indian tribes. He was lost without trace, as are so many brave explorers having entered the labyrinth of no return. Of course, it is not all jungle. The big rivers, such as the Purua, Maranon, Ucayali, and the Amazon itself, have sizable towns strung along their banks. In these towns there are schools and a certain standard of education. There are also the missions, and innumerable isolated villages strung like small beads along the thousands of miles of the water courses, from source to mouth. A very large population live in these river towns, missions and villages. Unhappily, it is no exaggeration to say that for every 10 people living in these communities, 8 suffer from disease of one kind or another. The drug stores of the larger settlements do a very thriving business. There is one on every street corner. On the upper Ucayali, a lot of victims, paralyzed by the dreadful beriberi sickness, may be seen. They hobble along on crutches everywhere, begging for a coin. When anybody decides to wander into the jungle, it is fiesta time for the insects. They wait for their prey, even, I swear, working a shift system so as not to miss anybody. The insects working the night shift are not the same as those working the early morning and late afternoon shifts. There are thousands of different types of insect, carrying hundreds of different types of diseases. Some of the insects are so small that they cannot be detected by the naked eye. But they are just as deadly as the larger, visible ones. Fish can be unpleasant as well. Again, they do not have to be big fish. I have already mentioned the piranha. This little monster's name is sometimes spelt piranha. No matter how the name is spelt, the fish is just deadly. The piranha attack in force whenever a hand or foot is put into the water. They haunt the vicinity of the riverside slaughterhouses, but the smell of blood from any animal anywhere at any time makes them the most deadly of living creatures. Within a matter of seconds, they are capable of stripping a man or an animal to the bone. But vegetation can be just as deadly. You have to watch out for poisonous leaves, sticks as sharp as needles, thorny vines as dangerous as barbed wire, all competing in nature's inexorable game, the fight to survive. Whilst waiting for transport from Iquitos, I made the acquaintance of a delightful American lady and her husband, a retired army officer. They were both enthusiastic amateur anthropologists, and spent 2 hours telling me about their hobby. A few days before I met them, Colonel and Mrs. Thompson, who came from Texas, had tried to locate a young guide, who was supposed to know all the answers concerning survival in the jungle, particularly if the intruders into the green hell were merely curious and inexperienced. The middle-aged colonel and his wife were both curious. They wanted to pay a short visit into the heart of the jungle, a risky venture that even the strongest and fittest young men of Iquitos fight shy of making. The Thompsons wished to contact the cannibals, who they believed live happy and without a care inside the jungle and not near the river where civilization has ruined their health and natural habits. They told me that they found this particular guide in a carpenter's shop, where he was repairing his outboard motor boat. The guide was a most unlikely red-haired Austrian, who sported an 8 months beard. He had, my new friends informed me, wild, crazy eyes, and was prone to making nervous gestures. But the guide was, Colonel Thompson hastened to inform me, a very interesting man indeed. The Thompsons proved delightful raconteurs, so for my benefit, they reenacted the scene at the Hotel de las Turistas where the three of them had gone to discuss the expedition over a round of drinks. "It'll take you for $200 each," said the guide. "Payable in advance," he added as a trenchant afterthought. "All right," replied the colonel. "You'll have to be prepared to live on monkey meat and snakes for a couple of weeks," continued the young Austrian. "Have you ever eaten monkey meat?" asked Mrs. Thompson. "Many times," the red-haired Austrian replied. "It tastes just like human flesh. Mrs. Thompson reported that she had almost fainted on the spot. "Oh. It's all right," the guide assured her when she had recovered her composure. "It isn't bad if it's roasted. As a matter of fact, my friends on the river know how to prepare a dead body so that it eats just like Christmas turkey." The colonel had tried to stop the guide from speaking in this vein, but the Austrian was not to be put off. "If you return from the trip, you're never the same anymore. It is easy for you to shiver and look disgusted, but if you are forced to go hungry for weeks, why should the flesh of a dead, old woman be any different from the meat of any old bird?" I made a few conventional remarks after the Thompsons had related this anecdote. "Did you make the trip?" I asked, then immediately answered myself. "No, of course you didn't. You say all this happened just a few days ago. You must have changed your minds." "You bet we did," said Colonel Thompson emphatically. "Why, if we had gone on that trip, and had got lost in the jungle, that fellow would have eaten my wife, and thought nothing about it." Evidently, the amateur anthropologists must have been very shaken by the episode. The very next day they went along to the office of the Peruvian airline in order to see about booking a return flight to Dallas, Texas. I decided that the colonel had been right. The red-haired Austrian guide seemed the most interesting character. After what I had seen and experienced in India and in other parts of the world, I did not think that I would turn squeamish over anything that this young man would be likely to tell me. So I sought him out, and found him in that same carpenter's shop that the Thompsons had described. "You know," he said, "these people, not just the Thompsons, but all others like them who come to this outlandish spot are all right in their way. But they take their prejudices with them like an extra skin wherever they go. You need years to prepare yourself for the jungle, and most white people turn savages themselves while doing so. Besides, who is to blame these Indians, if they eat their dead ones instead of cremating them? A piece of meat, carefully roasted over a hot fire, loses its identity. It could be beef, chicken, monkey, or man. And what's more, it's a natural way of getting rid of the dead. Perfectly natural, as you'll agree if you watch all the other creatures doing it. It's the natural justification of killing to appease hunger." He paused for a moment, but I offered no comment. I was happy to let him ramble on, expounding his philosophy. On the other side of the Yavari River, the red-haired guide continued, "I saw several white explorers turned native. They were the craziest bunch of nuts I ever saw. I'd been down with the fever for several days when I ran into them. I thought I was still delirious when I first saw them. The funniest people I have ever met, with hands so strange that I thought them to be from a different world." I pricked up my ears at this, but again kept my mouth shut. They might have talked a lot of nonsense, but they were such fine engineers. They even fixed a broken outboard propeller blade for me so that I could get back to the Yavari. It was the last of four blades that I'd started with, so you can judge how glad I was. For all their craziness, they were good at doctoring as well. The Austrian accepted with alacrity my invitation to go across to the hotel for a drinking session, and did not mind at all when I started to pump him about his adventures. "This fellow with the funny mouth, a legacy of some fever, I suppose," waved me a tablet to swallow. I felt better almost immediately. Then he gave me some fruit juice. That was the best fruit juice I've ever tasted. Yes. They were white folk turned native all right. I told them to give it up, and come back to civilization, but they refused. As for me, as soon as I was completely well, I came back out of the jungle as though all the devils in hell were on my tail. "Did anybody else see these white natives?" I asked. "I doubt it. I don't suppose anybody believed me when I told my tale. Later, I went upstream of the Yavani to Bolonzi. That's right up on the Brazilian border. I felt great. That tablet must have lasted a long time. I told the missionaries on the Brazil side of the border what I'd seen out there on the Yavari River. They wouldn't believe a word I said. Made out it was the fever. Said no white man would dare to go into cannibal country, and that, Christian or non-Christian, having your head shrunk to the size of an apple was no way of getting to heaven. I wouldn't argue with them. I know what I saw out there. The pause this time was much longer, the pull on the glass much more lingering. Although I was dying to ask him any amount of questions, yet I refrained from doing so. It is considered bad manners in this part of the world to be too inquisitive. And yet, people do open up when they have spent several months in solitude. They are in need of conversation. If the guide wanted to confide in me, then he would, but in his own good time. Meanwhile, I was content to sit and think over the implications of the story of his attack of fever out there in the jungle by the Yavari River, and how he had been cured by the white men who had turned native. "I think you really like me," the Austrian finally said, putting aside his empty glass. "You probably despise as much as I do the narrowness of your own hometown. In our towns and villages, a son is expected to follow the same occupation as his father. My father was a musician. He played in the Vienna State Orchestra, so he must have been pretty good. So I had to become a musician. When I was only 6 years old, I was forced to learn the violin. Twice a week the professor came to our house in Innsbruck. In the late afternoon, when school was finished for the day. I hated that man. Other kids could play football in the street, but I was forced to listen to the most dreadful noises you can imagine, produced by me, against my will, on an instrument I found was becoming more and more repugnant to me. And to think my father put that violin under the Christmas tree. Imagine a boy of 6 being landed with a violin when he'd been dreaming of a football." I nodded my head in sympathy. I could well imagine the anguish of a football-mad 6-year-old. People in South America are not like the bourgeois Europeans. Here, they do what they want to do, not what their parents want them to do. It doesn't matter a great deal whether or not they make a lot of money. They're just happy doing what comes naturally, and they're proud of doing it. Look at me for an example. I am importing hardware by plane from Lima. I sell it downriver, on credit. It isn't easy. When my customers see my boat coming, they disappear into the jungle, instead of paying me in rubber or with money. But in the end, I get paid, because we are all friends. It's a happy-go-lucky life. Most people in South America are like me. Think of the Brazilians, in Rio. They really are a happy lot. They've got the finest harbor in all the world. What a place to see at night from the cable car. What wonderful avenues, what luxurious hotels and shops. And they are courteous all the time. If you compare that with the rat race in Europe and in the United States, if you remember how the people who live there often have to dig themselves out of the snow and ice, then you begin to appreciate that here in South America people really are living. They live in paradise on earth. It's unhygienic, of course. But people here just don't vegetate from one workday to the next. They're really swinging. That's how I feel about living in South America. Swinging in the sun. That's for me. At last the Austrian had come to the end of his philosophizing. He got up to go, a contented man because he had got things off his chest, and had passed a comfortable hour drinking with me, incidentally, at my expense. I thought that I had listened long enough to ask a question or two, so I detained him with yet another refill of his glass. "That was something like an adventure in the Yavari River," I remarked. "Have you had any other adventures like that? Any with animals perhaps?" My intention was to draw him out into revealing some more details about the crazy white men who had turned native. Because of the pain-killing tablets he had received, there was little doubt in my own mind that he had perhaps encountered some people similar to Satura. But the Austrian guide had exhausted that subject. "I've had many adventures," he admitted. "Why, I had one the first week of arriving out here. I was only a youngster of 18 or so. I told you I couldn't wait to leave Austria and my family. It was the Christmas of 1946. I was in the Ukiah country then. I had my base at Pew called Papiru, and was just beginning to learn my trade. I had wandered down to the waterside. The river was in full spate, dirty, muddy, treacherous, and alive with piranhas. I was watching some native boys searching for turtle eggs. We were on a small beach, smooth and sandy. Suddenly, one of the boys shouted at the top of his voice. I thought he'd seen something big in the water. Then all the other lads started to make a fuss. They dashed into the water. They weren't in the water very long. They picked up something and came hurrying back, and I looked at what they'd found. It was a baby. A brown little baby girl. I was shocked. Who would do a thing like that? Of course, I hadn't heard about the little custom of the upstream Indians in the Akali country. If the family is hungry, if there are too many babies, then they throw the newborn girls into the river. Ironically, this tribe does not believe in killing, so they throw the live baby into the water knowing that the fish will get her. After saving the little girl, those kids stood round looking at the baby. They weren't doing a thing about it. So I stepped in, picked up the baby, and took it along to the Catholic mission in Pucallpa. I explained what had happened to the sisters, and they took the baby in. They thanked me, and invited me along to the christening. They arranged that right away. Instant christening, in case the baby should die of exposure. Maria Navidad they named the child. Maria for the Mother of God, Navidad because she had been found on Christmas Day. A remarkable story, I replied. As remarkable in its way as your story about the white natives. He wasn't to be drawn. I took that baby girl a few presents before I left Pucallpa. A bonny kid she was. Do you know what happened to her? I asked. I left Pucallpa the following summer, I wrote once a few years later. The sisters told me they were educating her at a mission school near Lima. I lost touch after that. I am not much of a letter writer. At any rate, this story has a happy ending. Only partly. The sisters told me the baby's mother had been beaten up by her own people. I understand the woman died soon after. Never heard tell of a father. So Maria Navidad must be an orphan. But you left her in good hands. That was commendable of you. I don't want any medals. Anytime you want to disappear into the jungle, just let me know. He left the hotel. He must have been a hardened drinker, and he had finished a bottle with gusto. I stayed at the bar for a longish time after he had gone. I didn't drink anymore. I just wanted to think over the things he had told me. It made sense, what he had told people about his homeland. I had met many of them myself in my travels. Many of the northern people are desperate people with a host of complexes. He was also right, generally speaking, about South America. The climate did make a vast difference. Admittedly, he studiously refrained from mentioning the disgusting poverty of the peasant people, and the filthy slums of Caracas, Lima, Bogota, Rio and the other major cities. His point was that as long as there is sunshine the people are, in the main, happy. You rarely find a depressed, desperate person in the sunny South American states. There are people living there as poor as European slum dwellers, but the South American peasant accepts his poverty with a smile. Nor do they fee their poverty to be a personal disgrace, with an accompanying psychopathic complex, as do the poor of the more northerly countries. As a matter of interest, I'd noticed that the majority of South Americans seem to work at the happy-go-lucky type of job. They work as fruit juice sellers. The beggars strum guitars. There are the wandering tin can collectors, the shoeshine boys, the coconut and candy salesmen, the sellers of onions and rotten vegetables, the third-class meat salesmen, the travelers and representatives who try to get rid of carbon paper, cheap perfume, candlesticks, plastic flowers, cigarette lighters and a host of other junk. Then there are the repairers of fountain pens, umbrellas, broken windows, and a host of other broken articles. There are the sellers of lottery tickets, newspapers, and funny stories. There are the revendedores of the theater, the cinema and the other places of entertainment. There are the cattle minders and the dog watchers. These are the people with the 1001 happy-go-lucky type jobs. There is simply no end to the imaginative work that will go to the filling of an empty stomach in South America. I remember one particular fellow I saw in Guayaquil. It was during my previous trip to South America, and I had to go up to Ecuador in connection with the installation of a medium-sized milling plant. I had finished work for the day, and after dinner I wandered around the town for an hour or so. I was in the harbor area when I came across a dentist.